book they admire.
You've heard Michiel Haines, Vanula Darling and Imran Kavadia, so you've had a bit of Russia and a bit of South Africa. Today is the opportunity for Yawande Omotiso to talk with to you about her views of the novel by Diana Evans, 26A. Yawande was born in Barbados and lived in Nigeria until she and her family came to South Africa in 1992, so we count her as South African. She has an architectural degree from UCT and worked as an architect for several years, as did some of her friends who are in here. But she's now a designer and a freelance writer living in Johannesburg. She completed her master's in creative writing at UCT in 2011, having before that period and during it and after contributed articles, poems, and short stories to various newspapers, magazines, and anthologies, including Okra magazine, The Sunday Times, and Farafina magazine. In 2011, her first novel, Bomb Boy, was published by Modraji Books to great acclaim. The book was shortlisted for the 2012 Sunday Times Fiction Prize, most unusual thing for a first novel, and it recently won the first novel award from SALA, the South African Literary Awards, given by the Department of Arts and Culture. Reviewers have spoken of the elegance of her writing, the originality of her vision, and the way she evokes loneliness. I encourage you to read her novel. I finished it about 2 months ago and can only recommend it to you. It is available on the book tables outside. Please welcome Yawande Omotiso.
Thank you very much. Good morning, everybody. Thank you for being here. I just want to start by really thanking the University of Cape Town and thanking the whole summer school program for inviting me to be here. You know, all the staff, I get a sense that a lot of hard work goes into turning out this project, and it's really worthwhile. So just to thank them in their absence, thank you, Ingrid, particularly for the personal invitation that you made to me, and that it was a real honor and pleasure that I could accept it. So it's great to be here. Before I begin, I want to just make you aware of something, which is that part of the story I'm going to speak about today involves sexual trauma and depression. And I want to just mention that, you know, for different people, there might be different appropriate responses to something like that. And I actually want to just give you a few minutes to think quietly by yourself and do whatever is appropriate for you about knowing this now. So my lecture is entitled The Pains and Solaces of Twinhood, and it concerns the debut novel of Diana Evans called 26A. 26A was published in 2006 by Random House. I read the book 2 years after it came out. The year I read it was also the year I decided to max out my credit card and pay UCT for a master's in creative writing. And a friend of mine, who's also a writer, told me about the book, and he said that it was in his top 10 list. And I'm way too much of a wimp to have something called my top 10 list of best books. But I read the book, and from that first reading, it's always remained really special to me. So I'm using the opportunity of this lecture to peel back and try and understand why that is. My lecture is essentially about why I love the book, why I keep recommending it, and what I think is special and unique about Evans and her craft. I'll start with the title of the lecture. The title I've given my lecture stems from the heart of one of the things I appreciate the most about the book: the magical, at times heart-wrenching way in which Evans captures the uncanny truths of life, one of which I believe are the opposing binaries of life, love and pain as bedfellows. Of course, all this is made more profound, the lesson more poignant, when told through the lives of a set of twins. The pains and solaces of twinhood. The intimacy of sameness, betrayed by the illusion of sameness, betrayed by the intimacy, betrayed by the illusion, and so on, and so on. But let's go back a bit before going forwards. 26A was released. It won Britain's inaugural Orange Award for New Writers, and it was shortlisted for the Whitbread First Novel of the Year Award. Another thing about the title, I need to admit, is that it is stolen. So I stole the title from the title of a review that I read of the book in the Guardian Review of Books, written by award-winning cultural critic Maya Jaggi. So in her review, Jaggi concedes that twins and doubles have always proved irresistible to writers. But she marks Evans as doing something different. Diana Evans is a twin. And in her book, she explores intimately what she terms two-ness in oneness. The reader is left with the painful confusion of what it is to long for that kind of togetherness that has its roots in before you were born, contrasted with a deep desire for selfhood, for a separate and distinct identity. Another opposing binary of life, I think, played out as a love struggle between the two main characters, sisters Bessie and Georgia. Okay, now, forwards. While I'm hopeful that most of you have read 26A, even just in anticipation of today, I won't assume so. And what I'm about to say is directed to perhaps those of you in the audience who haven't read the book yet. So if you go onto the internet and you snoop around a bit, you'll find a website called themoviespoiler.com. It's a horror if you appreciate surprises, or it's a blessing if you like to know what's going to happen. So I now confess that my lecture is going to be a bookspoiler.com for anyone who hasn't read 26A. And I asked UCT if at this point I could offer you the chance to leave the room and get a full refund. You can leave the room, but the refund they declined. But here's some good news. You know, 26A isn't a thriller. It's not a whodunit. I've read the book a number of times myself, and each reading was never experienced as less because I knew it was going to happen. To quote, in fact, a writer, teacher, and fellow summer school guest lecturer, Imran Kuvadia, he said, "Anything you read just once is disposable." And he says that King Lear is worth reading at least once a year. So it's not always about being surprised. Yes, you know, that might be the world of movies, but as kindred book junkies, which I'm going to happily assume you are, you know, we know the glories of going beyond cheap thrills, to be seduced by words made palpable by great artistry. So my disclaimer is over. Besides, I was only joking when I said that my lecture would spoil the book, but I thought it only fair to warn you. There are a few writers I've read where I felt a very strong connection to the writer herself, not just the text. Sinead Bedford is the earliest I can remember. I think I was 10 or 11 when my parents bought me the book. Yoruba Girl Dancing is a semi-autobiographical novel about a Nigerian girl's adjustment to life in an English boarding school, and it's set in the 1950s. This book is not the topic of my lecture, but I mention it as the first reading of something that it really struck a chord with me. I felt a link with the author, feeling as if she were telling my own story, as if she knew me personally. Toni Morrison, Zia Edgall, and when I was a little older, Arundhati Roy, are writers that have done the same for me. I didn't just read all their books, one after another. I read and watched interviews of them. And even more, I wondered about them, their lives, their thoughts. They were my heroes, my celebrities. If you're decent at pushing buttons, you'll come upon a smattering of information about Diana Evans and her life on the internet, beyond the typed biography that her publishers put on their website. She was one of six children, a younger sister, her twin, and three older sisters. Born in London to a Nigerian mother and a British father, she spent part of her childhood in Lagos. Evans studied media studies and was a dancer in a Brighton-based dance company. A detail which becomes interesting if you read her second novel called The Wonder, where she writes about a group of dancers living and loving in London. After university, Evans went on to become a journalist, and at the time of writing 26A, she just resigned as a writer for an industry music magazine. So my father's a Nigerian, and my mother, Barbadian. I have lived both in my fatherland and in a foreign one that would become home through the pressure of time and by default. I love my two older brothers intensely, and as young adults, when we all three went walking, we would occasionally be met with the odd, puzzled question, are you triplets? We're not. But lastly, like Evans, perhaps like a lot of English writers, I didn't study English. Instead, I collected a degree in architecture, and I too know what it is to leave a job that is solid and sensible, to chase a bunch of words around page after page, suffer the embarrassment of being considered slightly crazy, as well as the rapture of having little money but plenty fulfillment. So let me now move on to some of the specific elements that I loved about the book. This would include actual passages I have enjoyed reading over and over again. The story of the book will be revealed through my account. Let's see here, I'm gonna try and... There we are. So when asked if the novel was autobiographical, Evans answered that it was inspired by personal experiences and that she'd drawn from childhood memories and sensations. I only found out that the story I'd read was true after I'd read it. And somehow this knowledge that it was a true account made it more precious. Evans does insist, though, that the story became its own. She was careful to allow plot and character the freedom to take their twists during the writing process. "26A" is startling in how it moves from the magic realist entry of Bessie and Georgia Hunter into life, the humor of their childhood on Wafer Avenue, Nestine, to teenage angst, to dark moods, and mental instability, and even death. In addition, Evans doesn't only explore the relationship between twins, but she looks at another set of two, the parents, and succeeds in depicting their marriage with tragic humor. Early in the book, there's a scene where Ida and Aubrey, the Nigerian and British parents of the twins, are watching with their progeny the now famous wedding ceremony between Prince Charles and Lady Diana. The sweetness of the images is not only contrasted with the unhappy, cold marriage of Aubrey and Ida, but also with, you know, what the future would later reveal about the royal union, witnessed by many on television. I'm reading now from the book. "Cameras cannot catch the inside of a kiss. Charles's head stays still, and Diana receives him obediently. It is not a passionate kiss. There is no tender hand pressing into the small of her back, no arching against him and the round of her breasts seeping into his rib cage. Their lips shake hands. It is sealed. She belongs to him, and he belongs to his mother. There are bright sighs and chatter from the congregation, and then they are singing again the hymn, Christ is made the sure foundation." Always with subtlety, Evans shows up our fairy tales, the illusion of sameness that we're together as twins, as lovers, as friends. We're together and therefore safe from bad things happening, the illusion of this. The twins live together in the loft, 26A. They share a beanbag when there are big decisions to make. They take care of their hamster called Ham, plant roses and bake flapjacks. initially, the book occurs as a well-crafted but regular story of coming of age. However, through the use of magic realism, evoking the before life and the death of Hamster Ham and his burial, there is a foreshadowing of more morose times. Tragedy happens when Aubrey is posted in Nigeria. He moves with his family and they remain in Lagos for 3 years. It is here that a single incident acts as a seed, and the psychological separation between the twins begins to germinate. In an interview with Zoe Paxton, Evans says of twinness, it's a very special, magical relationship, and it's fascinating even to me, she says. Most people build armor to protect themselves from other people, but when you're a twin, everything's stripped down. You know each other so intimately, and you don't have that armor. What Evans explores, though, is what happens when one twin experiences a trauma and the other does not. In Lagos, Georgia finds herself walking through the expansive garden of the house they have taken up residence in. It is here the gate man corners her, distracts her by encouraging she show him her cartwheels, and forces himself upon her pre-teenage body. I'm reading from the book now. Cedric gave Georgia a rough kiss on the mouth. Georgia said, "Oh, no thank you," and her feet felt as if they turned into grass and grown there and wouldn't be able to go anywhere until they were pulled out. Cedric pulled Georgia's grass feet out of the ground and Georgia screamed. In the house, in her sleep, Bessie felt her face throb once. Cedric put his hand over Georgia's mouth. It took a lot of coordination to hold the legs in cartwheel, to cover the mouth, to undo his belt. She was wriggling in all directions. Further on, immediately after the rape, Georgia felt lines of cockroaches marching up and down her legs. She ran as fast as she could back to the house. She tried to think about how she could put the cartwheels and grass feet and the dark bushes like the evil forest and Cedric's hands and Cedric's belt into words that were sayable. It was the first time ever in this land of two-ness, in oneness, that something had seemed unsayable. In her article in the Approaching Otherness issue of online magazine Double Dialogues, Marie Lauritsen speaks to this idea, the significance of the separation between the twins. So much is indistinct between the two sisters, their features, voices, even sometimes their thoughts. Everything is shared, and they grow, and as they're growing, their characters are being formed in tandem, like any siblings who share a household, but even more intensely. But then trauma happens, confusing, as Lauritsen puts it, the symbiotic childhood oneness. And suddenly, Georgia is being formed by a different hand to Bessie. Her life is now irreversibly distinct. Lauritsen says, the great black hand of childhood sexual assault, an incident that deprived Georgia of her sunlight and the nowness of things, becomes all dominant. The effect is recognition of herself, this is of Georgia, as their darker side of character, Bessie as the lighter. You are light, I am shade, she says. The incident remains unsaid, and it sits between the twins. Bessie never finds out about what happened. Georgia cannot bring herself to ever share the darkness with her twin. She feels responsible somehow for keeping Bessie light and clean. Bessie, Georgia says in the book, is where bad things never happen. The separation between the twins gains steadily and plays out over the next two-thirds of the novel. The instance of abuse seems a catalyst as other forces in the twins' world start to push for apartness. For example, on returning from Nigeria, the headmistress asked to meet with their father. And she requests this meeting and suggests that the twins be put in different classes. She says, almost ominously, "Mr. Hunter, it's very important they do not remain too attached to one another. The world outside is a world of separation. They must be prepared." The irony here is that Georgia already knows this and is aching from it. She's acutely aware of what comes between her and her sister, even just the new friend they make in class, who insists on sitting between them. It doesn't exist only with twins, but perhaps looking at it through the lens of twins sharpens it. The pull for freedom, for solitary adventure, versus the cradle of love, the surrendering of yourself, including your wanderlust, to be with another. It is Bessie that confronts this binary. Perhaps because her innocence remains intact, it is she who entertains the thought of separation as an adventure, even a form of pleasure. In this scene, a precursor to when Bessie actually travels and spends 6 months away from her twin, she tests the boundaries of their two-ness. "You go," Bessie said. "I feel like staying out a while." "What for?" "Nothing. Just..." There was a hint of defiance in Bessie's tone. She watched Georgia walk away through the crowds with her shoulders narrow. She watched the top of her head disappear down the steps. And she began to walk. Just as if she was lost, she wandered through the streets and the back roads, looking in shop windows and restaurants. She walked into a cafe wearing an imaginary Spanish dress with a wide skirt and sat at the counter alone. Georgia was somewhere else. Bessie asked the waiter for anything in a long glass. She sipped it slowly, glancing at people walking in and out, a waitress wiping tables, the girl in the mirror with the plaits. It was just her. This is what oneness must feel like, she thought. Bessie travels to the West Indies. The twins exchange letters during their separation, but it's older sister older sister Belle, who plays the role in the book as a flawed guardian to her sisters. And it's her that calls Bessie home, reeling her back into two-ness in this strident appeal. "Dear Bessie, I'm sure you enjoyed Christmas on the island, and I don't mean to spoil your fun, but I think it is time to come home. I'm very worried about Georgia. At Christmas, she practically locked herself away in the loft and hardly ate a thing. She said, 'We're 19 soon. I'm going to be 19 without her.' You should come home, Bessie. She needs you. She's not like you, with your wings and your ease. Please come home and comfort your twin." Evans extrapolates the breach between Bessie and Georgia to its extreme. As Bessie revels in the pleasure of travel, of being away, of finding that she is also a person without the presence of her twin, Georgia seems to be hurtling in the opposite direction as she painfully and singularly grapples with depression. In reading this part of the book, I believe I'm reading some of the gentlest, most compassionate writing I've come across in a long time. I'm reading now from a scene with Georgia. "It was not always easy buying milk. Before the milk, or the tomato puree, or the newspaper could be bought, there were decisions to be made and questions to be answered. Up above her head was the decision to be made as to whether or not it was possible at this moment to actually do it, what with all that it meant. And making this decision required, first of all, an assessment of her current state of mind. Blue would suggest it was mildly feasible. Lilac even more so. Yellow was a good place, but she was not often yellow when it was difficult to buy milk. Orange meant it could be dangerous. Something terrible could happen on the way down the hall, or worse, in the street. It had happened before, the panic, the meanness in a face floating by, that would send her running back without the milk. And if she was red, an unforgiving place of chains and confusion, it was out of the question, absolutely. Milk, onions, a walk in the street, everything. In the last third of Evans's novel, The Story Turns, and with further reading on her life, you learn it is not only being a twin that equips her to tell this story, but also a sad and mythical experience. Dinah Evans wrote an article called My Other Half, published in The Observer. Of her twin Paula, she writes, "From very early on, we had relied on each other as a reference point for who we were. In a sense, we needed each other in order to feel complete." This description is also fit for romantic love at the pinnacle of the fantasy, finding that one other who completes what was previously an incomplete equation. But you had to really look for him or her. Or maybe you didn't, but you certainly weren't conceived together, and you wouldn't have had the opportunity to share a womb, to have known each other before birth. In the same article, Evans writes, "For most of her adult life, Paula had been prone to bouts of depression. She even told me once that she felt suicidal, an admission that I digested more as an expression of how depressed she felt rather than something that was building into an actual intention. The greatest misjudgment I could have made." A few weeks later, she was dead. She was found in her flat 2 days after she killed herself. Despite all the warning signs, the news of her death was still the greatest shock imaginable. Shocking in its finality, its cruelty, its matter-of-factness, and its disparity with how I had witnessed the world up until that point. In the story, after their 21st birthday celebration, where all the sisters go out and dance, and the twins share an ecstasy-induced hallucination, Georgia begins her final unraveling. Reading from the book, "Summer turned. It flickered through the rooms and turned away. Georgia told Katya, who is her therapist, that she was experiencing panic. She had been to John Lewis to buy a present for Ida and had taken a plate off the shelf. As she held the plate, which was made of clay, she became extremely worried that she would drop it. Her fingers squeezed the sides of the plate. She held it for half an hour, not moving. Then she bent both knees, concentrating, and went lower, put the plate on the floor, and walked out. Outside the shop, she had started running. Endurance, said Katya. Tell the monsters they are not real. But Georgia was losing her words. Something irreversible had happened. The panic was connected to the change in season and the realization that neither warmth and light nor the opportunity to merge into the darkness of winter might save her. She fell with the leaves in autumn, and in November she got a headache that would not go." In reading this part of the book, I think Evans is brave to delve into the watery mind of what it must be like as you consider making your own death. Especially because what she's also writing in a parallel world are the thoughts, experiences and sensations her twin went through as her final day approached. Evans shows us Georgia watching her family, her boyfriend, but mostly watching Bessie. Georgia observing those close to her and their grasp of life, their love of life, something that is becoming more and more slippery for her. Georgia is also plagued with this continual sense that as she lives in misery, she's a thief to those she loves and their happiness. Trusting that she will live on in them, she comes to some understanding that life is not for her. It is here Evans plays dangerously, I think, with a controversial view of suicide. In an interview with 3AM online magazine, Evans describes Georgia as one of those people who just didn't like it in the world, who finds life difficult, who can't fit themselves into society's frameworks. Suicide, says Evans, is generally seen in a very negative way. And though it is tragic and devastating, I've learned from losing my own twin that there's a positive and magical side to it as well. It's about a person freeing themselves. It is actually a very courageous thing to do. To leave can be braver than to just stay and struggle on. I think this is controversial. I'm not an expert in this, and I'm not going to make any judgment about what she says, but it struck me. It was very startling. And it's probably a rather unpopular view to the more conventional idea that suicide is an act of weakness. At the height of their apartness, the twins, for the first time in the story, argue. So I'm reading from the book. All of a sudden, it bothered Georgia wildly that Bessie had never known the terror that could exist in buying milk, or making a cup of tea, or waking up alone in the middle of the night, or being happy right through and watching Red crawl towards you to take it all away. All this time, I have carried and protected you so that it would stay easy for you always, so that you'd never have to feel like me. I needed somewhere that wasn't bad. I wanted to be light and happy like you. And I wanted never for you to see the dark. I was scared I would infect you with terrible feelings and pictures in my head of walking out in front of the traffic. In response, Bessie is puzzled and annoyed that Georgia thinks she has been the one doing the protecting. Bessie lashes back, and the quarrel hangs unresolved. The two, who have never had to explain themselves to each other, have lost some facet of that implicit understanding. After the quarrel, instead of any relief, Georgia feels guilt. I am a thief, she thought, as she climbed the stairs after Bessie. I have stolen from you. Dan Evans' intentions, was to write about depression without writing about the actual emotions. Learning from an author she admires, Jean Race, she says of her, Race ascribes emotional qualities to the object, the environment, the street, the weather, and she always arrives at a really strong sense of character as a result of it. So Evans sets out to do something like that, and I really think that she's been successful. I'll read you a paragraph from the book where she's recounting some of Georgia's experiences. As time went on, the rumble of Tottenham traffic spread into Georgia's head. It was as if it was always there, and the people were always pushing, and the cars were always sneering at her, and the men on West Green Road were always shouting. There were few hills. It was London. In a way, Nestine was not London. It had no river and none of the right ghosts, no alleyways with silver streaks, and no lofts for kingdoms of two. The first appearance of Red was in a lecture where Georgia put her hand up to ask a question that she then forgot when she put her hand up. She sat there with her hand in the air and couldn't put it down. The eyes of the other students waited. Questions lurched off the ceiling and squabbled. She lifted the other arm and used it to bring down the arm in the air. She got up and left, and went straight home and lay down, it became difficult some days to buy milk. The dedication at the start of the book, two words, to Paula, these words alone are perhaps insufficient, even to a careful reader, that the story they're about to read is an offering to a ghost. Reading from the book. Just before the phone rang, Bessie was drowsy, and she allowed herself to imagine, what if? She saw herself alone in a tunnel, turning around in circles and falling to the ground. She saw herself get up and walk down the passage without a face. Her last thought was this: if she has gone, I will not forgive me. Then the phone rang. Bessie picked it up. Bell spoke the words. In the red night, Bessie screamed. She dropped the phone and kept on screaming. Afterwards, she sat cross-legged in the middle of her bed. She didn't understand what to be. A blogger and a Diana Evans fan once wrote that no one writes about death like Diana. I agree. I know I spent the last 30 pages of the book in tears. Not only on my first reading, but subsequent ones. But when I tracked back, I couldn't find what the words were. What was it that was written? What was the thing that made me cry? Rather, the intense sadness of loss, perhaps coupled with my own memories of my mother's death, seeped from the ink, each page imbued with a deep sorrow. Strangely, it is not Bessie's response to her twin's passing that struck me, but rather the plaintive accusation, to no one in particular, that the mother Ida makes when she's informed of her child's death. The words are that much sadder because they are too late. "You bring her to me," she says. "When she is sick, you bring her to me." After George's death, Diana Evans evokes an aspect of ancient Igbo history. During the 19th century and the early 20th century, the people of Southeast Nigeria, amongst them the Igbo, considered the birth of twins to be against nature and inherently evil. The twins would be placed inside calabashes and thrown into the Igbo forest. The land of spirits is something that every town or village in Igbo land had. The advent of Christianity, famously the nun Mary Slessor, was one of the things that succeeded in convincing people to stop killing twins. But Evans draws from the history in the completion of her tale. Early in the book, Ida's father, the grandfather of the twins, tells this story to the children, this myth. Well, it's a piece of history, but it's mythologized in the book. And the myth goes, a long time ago, people believed that twins came from witches who lived in the forest. The witches flew around and around the treetops on their brooms. They ate birds and made skirts from the feathers. And when they were at their most evil, they gave birth to twins. That is what people believed. Twins were a curse, the children of devils. And they had to be destroyed. So this is what they did. They took the second twin and burnt it. He told them of a woman who once had two girl twins who were best friends from the very beginning, even before they were inside their mother's womb, when they were spirits. Their names were Onye and Ode. Onye was first, Ode as second. They set her on fire. When Ode was burnt, Onye got sick and wouldn't eat at all until Ode's ghost entered her body. The ghost came in, and Onya began to eat again from her cursed mother's breast. But Ode could not stay for forever. She could only stay for 1 year, because that was how long it took for the soul to be ready to leave the earth. So drawing both from this history, the myth of spirit twins returning, and from her own experience of being visited by her twin after her death, Evans writes how Georgia returns in Bessie, and they take a year to say goodbye. With an interesting twist of craft, Evans introduces first person into the narrative, Georgia is the eye. I'll read you a short paragraph. It's dark outside, and the rain and the moon have turned the streets to glass. On the short drive from JP's back to Wafer Avenue, Bessie looks out through the car window, and there are questions in her head. Is it you? She asks. Her ribs are aching now as I shift and climb, as I struggle to arrive completely. In my other half, Dinah writes of what it was like for her. She says, in the journal I was keeping at the time of Paula's death, there's a blank space of 3 or 4 days. Those blank pages say everything about what it is to suddenly discover that your twin is no longer alive. After the initial shock, there is nothingness. The opposite of shock. There are no appropriate words and no real thoughts, only sensations, flinches of confusion and bafflement, a feeling of numbness. It seemed virtually as if I had also ceased to exist. But there was, too, something exquisite about that time. I might say something in the exact tone of voice in which Paula would say it, a slightly lower, softer pitch, or her edgy laughter would tumble out of my mouth. I would feel an unmistakable sense that I was she, just for that moment, that she had borrowed me for an instant to get a word in about something, or say hello to the person I was with. What I love the most about 26A connects us back to the beginning of my lecture, back to the title, back to these bedfellows, pain and love. It's confusing, and you wonder if there's any wisdom to it. And you think of earnest aunties who warn, if it hurts, it's not love. But surely it is love, just a love not without irony. Perhaps the same for any love story, real or imagined. The love between Bessie and Georgia is complete, without effort. It's a secret language on its own, and the rest of the world happens only on the outskirts of it. The reason I cry in the last pages of the book is because Evans has spent the first few pages creating a clear picture of the magnitude of this love. It only hurts so much because the love is so great. Maybe if Bessie and Georgia were not twins, just normal sisters, or maybe they were cousins, neighbors, perhaps they hated each other. Maybe, you know, Bessie actually fantasized about Georgia's death. It's a different book, obviously, a different story. But notice what happens to the pain. It changes. And in the most latter example, it might even be said to disappear altogether. And that's the irony, the wicked joke. We mourn the death of the loved one. The pain is piercing, and time does very little to ease it. We mue the death, but we never rue the day that we loved, even though the one only exists because the other does. In an article in the New York Review of Books, writer Zadie Smith describes joy as that strange admixture of terror, pain, and delight. For me, and it is merely my interpretation, just considering her examples of her relationship with her daughter and her husband, what she's really talking about when she says joy is love. The thing, this is what Smith says, the thing no one ever tells you about joy, writes Smith, is that it has very little real pleasure in it. And yet if it hadn't happened at all, at least once, how would we live? I hate to be trite, but the statement that keeps bouncing around in my head is, love is for the brave. A bravery you hope you have if twinness has been hoisted upon you, or a bravery you choose to have when you decide or wake up and realize that you're in love. On this matter, in his book, The Four Loves, C.S. Lewis wrote, "To love at all is to be vulnerable. Love anything, and your heart will be wrung and possibly broken. If you want to make sure of keeping it intact, you must give it to no one, not even an animal. Wrap it carefully round with hobbies and little luxuries. Avoid all entanglements. Lock it up safe in the casket or coffin of your selfishness. But in that casket, safe, dark, it will change. It will not be broken. It will become unbreakable, impenetrable, irredeemable. Evans, I think, understands this, if not from her first-hand experience of loss, then definitely from the sad but cathartic process of writing 26A. She understands the weave between the pain and solace of deep intimacy, that they are bound up, conjoined, and that we are not lesser because of it, but greater. Thank you very much.